a new school year is about to begin all across the country and in all kinds of different places where learning and teaching takes place. And I thought it was a great opportunity to air an interview about a book which takes a very unvarnished look at what it is like to teach in one of the most difficult environments that a teacher can face. I'm going to be speaking for the next few minutes with Michael Kopperman, who now teaches at the University of Oregon, but right out of his undergrad years at the tender age of 22, he engaged in a two-year program called Teach for America, which took him to an incredibly poor school in an exceptionally poor school district in the Mississippi Delta region of the state of Mississippi. And he looks back on that experience in a book called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, in which he offers us a very frank chronicle of his struggles, his dreams as a young teacher in such a school, teaching students bearing so many burdens, disadvantaged in so many different ways, hoping desperately and working desperately to try and make a lasting difference in their lives. And for anybody who cares about teaching, for anybody who is a teacher, or anybody who just longs for us to better understand the process of learning and longs for us to give more equal, equitable opportunity to students all across the country, no matter where they live, this is an important book for you to read. Again, it's called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, published by University Press of Mississippi. And Michael Kopperman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for writing such an amazing book. I happen to be a college professor myself. I'm married to a public school teacher, and I care very much about teaching and the challenge that confronts teachers, especially those who teach in really, really difficult situations. So I am especially appreciative of this opportunity to speak with you. Can you say a word about what prompted you to want to become a teacher in the first place? And can you point to any particular moment in your life when it became clear that this is the path that you should seriously pursue?
Well, and you know, it's interesting. But as much as I had a lot of background in teaching in various capacities, meaning, you know, in college, I had taught a college class. I was involved with various advocacy groups, and at Stanford, the multiracial issues chair. I was the multiracial issues chair of an organization that had fought for, you know, checking multiple boxes on the census. And I had taken a lot of classes about inequality. And I had taught the martial art of Aikido while I was a college student. I don't know that I really thought of myself, or at least as my, I didn't think of my path as being towards education until I did Teach for America. And more particularly, in fact, until I found myself in the rural black public schools of the Mississippi Delta.
Can I just interrupt for a second? Did you graduate then with a degree in education? Or in something else?
I was an English major with you know, a minor or a focus in creative writing. And, you know, I think in so many ways that is what the organization Teach for America attempts to do, right? They usually try to find students who are not necessarily confirmed in a path towards education or who wouldn't normally be going straight into something like a master's program, intending to become a public school teacher. Their intention is to take students who otherwise show promise and ability, right, and send them to the areas that are most disadvantaged in this country that have the greatest teacher shortages.
Wow. It's an intriguing scenario because, on the other hand, there is certainly a laudable purpose behind it. On the other hand, it is also, in a sense, feels a little like leading a lamb to slaughter in the sense of of placing people who do not have the same kind of background of having taken education classes and all that it takes to be an effective teacher. They give you some orientation, but nothing that can equate what an education major would receive, and then take you into especially challenging environments. In some respects, that sounds like a scenario that is primed more for inevitable defeat than victory. Do you see it that way, or is it or is there more promise than we might at least initially assume?
Well, I think that the very complicated questions tied up, right, with especially the way that programs like Teach for America, or here in Mississippi, Teacher Corps, or all sorts of programs that are similar, functional across the country. I think what I would say is that as much as I have had to go back and educate myself and learn more about teaching over the years, and as important, I think, as education programs are all across the country, I'm not sure that anything prepares any teacher for the actual experience of the classroom, and especially the experience of a classroom in the more disadvantaged areas in our country where, you know, where the public schools in many cases are extremely difficult and the circumstances of the children are difficult and the schools themselves are badly under-resourced. I think that those situations are often different. We also know that teaching for a first year anywhere in the country is difficult. I may not be up to date with the most current statistic, but it was my impression that something like 50% of teachers don't last through their first year or out of the classroom within 5 years. And so if you think about that kind of attrition rate, then you would have to say, since most of those teachers are going through traditional teaching programs, that teaching is immensely difficult anywhere.
Mm.
And that perhaps, you know, what makes you an educator is in part your preparation and coming to understand what it means to teach. But also the direct experience of children in classrooms.
Right.
And in that sense, for me, though I was not prepared at all, the experience of teaching in Mississippi did make me into a teacher.
Right. Can you say a little more about the nuts and bolts of how Teach for America works? I mean, how one gets into the program and how assignments are given, that sort of thing.
I believe that Teach for America takes folks who specify a preference for a certain area or region. Their admissions process is extensive and complicated. They try to have fairly rigorous sessions in which people are sort of selected on the basis of how they teach a sample lesson, long-form interviews, sometimes with multiple screeners, who themselves have at least taught a couple years or more. And they're looking for certain character traits. They want a demonstrated record of achievement and excellence. They want to see persistence in various ways. They like evidence of leadership. And so, you know, the organization is attempting in many ways to find people who can overcome the obstacles that they might face and the challenges they will inevitably face in a classroom. They're also looking for, I guess we would say, excellence. And of course, one of the charges against Teach for America is elitism, which I think is a fair question.
Say more. At least say more about
that. The year that I applied, they took something like 1 in 12 applicants. So if you think about that rate, that's more, you know, if there are 12 people who are saying that they want to go teach in under-resourced schools and you take one of them, at first you have to think about those other 12 people, right, who could potentially have had some sort of impact. Of course, there are lots and lots of ways that they could find their way into a classroom. But then the organization is basically saying that because they are taking excellent candidates, right, that will then help create long-term leaders and people who have direct experience within the classroom to try to make a difference.
Do you know very much about how a given school district becomes part of this program? I assume it's pretty obvious that that a school district, at least to some extent, needs to opens its arms in welcome of this, that you don't simply storm the barricades and take up shop there without being asked. Do you know very much about sort of the way in which this takes place?
It is my understanding that that a school-level administrator, like a principal, has to request and want core members in order to have them be placed in their school. And then at a district level, most districts have full choice and have to request core members. So, you know, I know that there are tremendous frictions that have occurred, or at least the perception is, in some places where there are, you know, where there is a body of teachers who have master's degrees and who would actually want to be going into the schools, occasionally there has been the idea that perhaps, you know, core members or Teach for America is trying to place teachers when there could be teachers who would not simply be signing on for a two-year stint. But in a place like rural Mississippi, or in the Mississippi Delta with the particular organization here, this year, for example, they had 2,000 requests for placements of Teach for America teachers, both because it's been their experience over nearly 20 years that there is a high level of quality with those teachers, and because the shortages are so great in terms of having really qualified people to be in the classrooms. And so they placed 74 this year.
Wow.
So if you think about that sort of, you know, statistic, then I think that at least in a place like Mississippi, you know, you tend to think that Teach for America is certainly not displacing experienced teachers, and that there is a tremendous need here.
We're speaking with Michael Kopperman about his book, Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. You ended up being placed in a place called Promise, Mississippi. And I was tempted to ask you if you made up the name, because, of course, in so many respects, the name is sort of bitterly ironic, because you describe this community as something that shows anything but promise to most of its citizens. Tell us more about Promise, Mississippi, and whether or not it was an accident that you were placed there, or if there was any rhyme or reason to you finding your way to this particular assignment.
It's most interesting. I have changed names of places and of the school and of children. That's just a responsibility to protect the privacy of young men and women who came into my charge as a teacher without, you know, certainly having acquiesced to being in a book. And so I think I have a responsibility to protect who they were as children, even though, you know, something like 12 years has elapsed since I was last teaching them. And in terms of the community, and this was once I had sort of been placed into a region, it was simply about need. The particular town that I was in was a town of about 10,000 people approximately. And, you know, it, like much of the Delta, which is, of course, the Delta is geographic, right, as a feature. It's the alluvial floodplain of the Mississippi, the 100-mile swath that perhaps is most fertile. And so it's the place where the legacy of King Cotton was the greatest. It is both Arkansas. There's an Arkansas Delta and a Mississippi Delta, right, on the two sides of the river. And it is and remains perhaps the blackest part of the United States. It is something between 75 and 80% African American. The economics of the area are challenged. Whites still own 95% of the businesses in the Delta. And in the public schools, you find that there is complete segregation, or very near complete segregation, in many areas in a way that I think most Americans don't necessarily think of when they think of America in the year 2016. There are private white academies for white students to attend. There are scholarships at those academies to ensure that poor white students don't have to attend public schools with black students. And then the schools themselves are tremendously under-resourced and understaffed often. And so the situation in the town that I entered, you know, when I came from a place like Oregon, was, or more recently from Stanford, was, you know, was quite a shock.
Like another planet, I should think.
Much like that, in some ways. And I think, you know, I think that my experience very quickly became the children in the school. And of course, I found there that the children were, as children are everywhere, you know, brilliant and full of potential, and sometimes bad and sometimes wonderful.
Say a word about your own ethnic background, because in the racial situation which you describe in the community that you call Promise, Mississippi, you say race in Promise was complex. And, of course, you yourself were sort of a complicating element in that picture because of, in a sense, who you were and how you were viewed.
Yeah, I mean, so I am a mixed race, Russo-Polish Jew meets Japanese Hawaiian, and I'm extremely ethnically ambiguous in appearance. And so in Mississippi, which has a tremendously firm black-white binary, right, and all of the history which weights those divisions and which plays out today, that's what causes the segregation in these schools. I came in right in between. And so, you know, it was quite curious. I would feel eyes on me, you know, often wherever I went. That wasn't necessarily some sort of malevolent attention. Difference simply stands out everywhere. And it wasn't as if I wasn't used to that, because back in Oregon where I grew up and where I attended public schools, I was often one of a few minority students. But in Mississippi, it was different in the sense that, you know, to many of the children in the school that I taught who were all African-American, I was an oddity. You know, I was Jackie Chan. I was, as they like to say, a Chinaman. Those times when I encountered folks in the white community, there would often be some vaguely awkward interaction in which they would say something which I think to somebody from a more urban environment would seem to be potentially racist, although they were trying to connect something about my people or what are you, or you know, something about how they liked or enjoyed sushi. And then they would move from there often to making statements about my public school students, apologizing to me for having to teach children like that, or trying to communicate to me what was said to me, perhaps hundreds of times, explaining how, you know, in the rest of the country, things were different, but here in Mississippi, you know, the good blacks all moved away. And so what we have left is ... And so, you know, finding myself between and then sort of feeling as if one community, which I was really not a part of, was trying to pull me onto their side, and then where my allegiances were often to a community where I was not necessarily immediately recognizable. That was a challenge. And yet, of course, within the school, and certainly among my fellow teachers and with the children, I was an educator. I had a role, and that was to teach the children. And they very quickly, of course, understood me to not be Jackie Chan.
What kind of preparation were you given by Teach for America? And in retrospect, do you think that preparation or orientation was sufficient?
Well, so, you know, I would say that I had a very excellent and brief and intense teaching module and the kind of practicum within summer classrooms in Houston, in the public schools in Houston, which happened to be all black and Latino in the particular school that I was placed with, kids of a similar age group to what I taught, to who I taught in Mississippi. You know, I taught 9 to 13 year old fourth graders in Mississippi. I think I taught 9 to 11 year old fourth graders when I was in Houston for those 5 weeks. And I think when I look back, I think that the failure to perhaps absorb all of what folks were trying to communicate to me was in some ways my own. I had just graduated college. I didn't go to celebrate the night of my own graduation. I got on a plane and went to the institute to begin training, after, you know, leaving my family who had traveled all that way in California. And I think that the organization, Teach for America, does its best, and it's my understanding that in the decade since, that they have vastly improved and changed as an organization the preparation that they try to put people through. And they try, of course, to do that in terms of having folks be in the classroom and get direct feedback in terms of the training that they're getting.
Right.
I was not prepared when I hit the classroom, but I am uncertain anything can prepare someone to begin teaching anywhere, let alone to begin teaching in the sorts of schools that we find in a lot of our under-resourced areas.
Right.
And I think most teachers can you know, probably identify with that situation, their first classroom, those mistakes that they made, the things that they didn't know but they really couldn't have known, responsible for a classroom full of children.
Right. Describe the school and your classroom. And what a shock it must have been for someone who came from the relatively privileged background from which you emerged and for whom what you had experienced up until then.
Well, I mean, the school is, and it's interesting because I'm in Mississippi right now, and so I just visited the school, hadn't seen it in a decade, and it looks quite similar, although parts of it have gotten coats of paint. You know, the school was brick, and in some cases cinder block. There were fairly bare concrete covered walkways. You know, it was partly landscaped, but often the grass, at least in August when I got there, had gone brown. And there was a fence that circled the school. You know, an 8-foot wire fence topped with razor wire. And it was never clear to me that whether that was intended to keep the children in or keep them out. sorry, keep others out. But you know, the school was in many ways a shock to me. When I entered my classroom with something like 5 days to teach, trying to prepare my first year, I found basically, you know, a layer of dust, chairs upturned, textbooks from this, you know, from the 80s and 90s, sort of mixed indiscriminately with a few new textbooks. A teacher had been there for quite some time and had moved on, and, you know, I don't know whose responsibility it would have necessarily been to have cleaned it out, but it was a bit of a disaster.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I did what I could that first year. The second year, I worked harder to try to have the classroom be a more welcoming place.
One of the things that's striking about how you describe yourself as you entered this is the enthusiasm and sense of hope that you and at least the vast majority of your counterparts seem to have. I mean, maybe not fully grasping just how difficult the situation was going to be, but nevertheless, really believing fervently that you were going to be able to make a real and lasting difference in these students' lives. I think one of the most poignant moments in the book is when you describe that first day that you went into your classroom with your class roster, and then all the signs you put up all over the room, like, "Together, yes, we can. There is no can't, only won't. And with willpower, we can do anything." I wonder if you can describe your state of mind as you were about to begin teaching. Was your sense of optimism real, or was it, in a sense, a sort of a suit of armor you were putting on with which to better engage in what was going to be a tough battle? I mean, just how profoundly and authentically optimistic were you as this school year began?
I mean, it is almost impossible to get back to the young man that I was, but I can tell you that I can tell you that I was filled with expectation and hope, that I believed, right, that that together, right, myself and my students were going to, you know, ascend to the promised land of educational achievement, and that, of course, in a single year, you know, by working together, we were going to achieve some sort of grace which would carry, you know, children from the lives they were born into and their circumstances and the schools that they would have to keep on in to some sort of, you know, better world. Mm. And that was naive, although I will say that the years, or what I thought of as a burden of years, also reveals surprises. And so, you know, the young man that I was, who can't be recaptured, wanted too much and believed perhaps in the wrong things. I thought that it was about me and what I could achieve. There was certainly a certain self-investment and narcissism and cynicism to the ways that I entered, believing that it was about what I could do. And of course, you know, the children themselves were just were just children from a community which was tremendously impoverished, coming from schools which often had not prepared them for the fourth grade, with obstacles and barriers to their success, often in terms of what was happening at home and in the streets and in the school itself, with my relatively inadequate instruction. And so, you know, I think that I wanted a lot. What's interesting is that I continue to want a lot. I mean, I spent the last 10 years in Oregon teaching a very similar group of students who have made it to college despite all the obstacles to their success. And I know from teaching those students and from the children I taught in Mississippi that there are no guarantees in terms of, you know, what it is that I want for students. But I have to say that having just met with three of the students that I taught some 12 years ago, none of whom I had seen in the ensuing years, who had found me on social media after many years and contacted me, and then in some cases who I just recently found again as I was here in Mississippi through other students. I, perhaps in this book at times, have been too hard on myself and the young man that I was and what I wanted. And what I mean by that is that, you know, there's a student that I begin this book with whose circumstances were perhaps more difficult than every other student. I cast her for a time as an anecdote, a success story. You know, the young woman entered my classroom reading in a fourth grade level and left at an eighth grade level. She loved books because books were a refuge from what was a very, very difficult situation in her home life. The water was often turned off at her house, sometimes the electricity. She was caring for a younger brother, perhaps cousin, often after school. Her mother was having a very difficult time of things. And the other kids mocked her relentlessly for being poor, which is, of course, an absurdity, right? In a place where all of the students basically qualify for free lunch. That young woman, who I describe in the book as filling me with the ultimate uncertainty. A fire came when I returned to the community after 4 or 5 years and her house had been burned out. I visited her on the campus of a four-year college this last week.
Wow.
And talked with her, talked with an immensely poised and bright young woman who had somehow made her own way. She used to love to read Harry Potter because of the you know, the transport and escape, the ways that the children were empowered, right? They always had magic and to, you know, defeat whatever was before them. This young woman who in the book I believe I call Serenity Warner, Serenity dreamed herself into a different life and then willed herself there. Yes? And I can't imagine how difficult these ensuing years have been. She found a slightly more stable living situation. She worked harder than I think is probably imaginable to get where she is. She is going to be finishing this fall. She's entering her last semester and has most of her difficult classes out of the way. And she is going to be applying to master's programs in social work, intending to go back and help young people like herself, because she understands how difficult it is when you ask a child to do too much.
Mm.
And she is very much the same in all kinds of ways as she was then. And it was most interesting talking to her, and, you know, and she remembered every detail of that year in that classroom. And yet in many ways, it was hard for her to get back to the child that she was because of the years that have come between. And it was funny to me because I was trying to tell her about some of the educational failures that, you know, the things that I had tried to do, the things that on reflection I had wished that I had done or done better for her, for the other children, mistakes I'd made. And she said something like, you know, we forgave you that when it was there because you cared about us.
Mm-hmm. So that much was evident, even if you didn't always know exactly what you were doing.
That's right. And it wasn't either that anyone was going to be giving me some sort of accolades for having done so much either. I do believe that I gave her an opportunity. Mostly it was an opportunity for her to realize her own potential. You know, she read herself into those four grade levels of gain in reading simply by having access to books.
At this point, I want to pause the interview in order to read a passage from Michael Kopperman's book, Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. The book opens with a chapter titled Uncertainty, in which he chronicles the experience of returning to Promise, Mississippi, 6 years after he left there. And this is part of what he writes. It includes a really moving passage about this student he was just talking about, a student whom he calls Serenity. I start the car and drive the streets again. I frequently took children home through these potholed streets and look now for the kids I taught, though they'll be grown now teenagers, and who knows if I'll recognize them at all. Children turn to point from the sides of the road, and I do not know them, but I look anyway for recognition in their eyes and find only fascination, innocence, excitement. I search for landmarks and find them readily. Deshaun's house, nobody outside I can see. Mrs. Mason's place, better kept than the rest, the siding new, the lawn almost green. And then I come to Serenity's house and stop the car, stunned. The porch and front door and the left side of the front wall are still there, burnt black and umber at the edges. The roof is gone, everything but the frame taken to ashes and rubble. I leap from the car, leaving it still running, as if there's something to be done, and stand in the still air with the motor chugging behind me and the sun beating down and all the ruin before me. And there's nothing to speak of how or why or what. Nothing to reveal what happened. And suddenly, I'm filled with the story I didn't intend to tell. Serenity loved reading more than any other student in my class. She wasn't the fastest reader or the brightest student. That honor was reserved for Felicia Jackson, my evil genius. The difference was that Serenity loved reading, loved books. She was poor, from a family, the Warners, who made the baseline poverty of other children seem first world. Serenity's uniform skirts were spotted with bleach stains and grease stains. Often she smelled a sour intestinal scent of body, though it was hard to say if that was because she hadn't showered or her clothes hadn't been washed. Her ill-fitting khaki pants, bunched at the waist, held there by a fraying woven belt, the cloth flat and baggy and unraveling at the bottom, where it appeared to have been scissored short. a larger hand-me-down cut to length, but not to size. One pair of her khakis had holes at the pocket line, and though Serenity went to lengths to hide them, sometimes a view of her cotton underwear was evident. More than once I'd caught a child snickering or mocking her, and had pulled them into the hall and lectured them on the shame of such cruelty. Serenity handled herself well with the insults. She ignored them. Only Felicia, with her talent for finding vulnerability, could get to Serenity, whom she called Raggedy S and Smelody and Serene Nasty. These insults only worked once, when Felicia first deployed them. Other children picked them up, but by then, Serenity was hardened against them. Perhaps this harassment was the reason Serenity loved so much to read. In books lay sanctuary from the unpleasant present. She made my classroom by 7:30 each morning after dropping off her little brother Willie at his third grade classroom. She greeted me with a measured smile and a wave, and immediately barricaded herself in beanbags at the corner behind my desk and opened her book. She kept a book at her desk, and our agreement was that she could read the moment she finished her work. She gave me her book to hold at the lines for lunch so that she could read at recess, where she'd either stay near me so that I'd keep the other children from harassing her, or sit with her back at the corner of the fence so as to be able to see the other children coming. After school, she fetched her brother from the lower school and stayed as long as she could, often until 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. She kept an eye on Willie, who was a bundle of energy and angst, a pain for me to manage, though I let him stay anyway. She was careful, too, to find a place away from Felicia, who often stayed afternoons helping clean the classroom and prepare for the next day. Serenity had, she said, nothing to go to. She was solely responsible for Willie through the evening, and no adult ever checked on her. When asked where her mother was, she would shrug and say quietly, "Somewhere." I asked around and found that the word among the children was that Serenity's mother was always messed up, that folks laughed at her behind her back and sometimes mocked her to her face. I was determined to reach her, to create a safe space for her to learn. She deserved a chance, that much was clear, and every book I put in her hands was enrichment. I'd go to her when she was reading and ask questions about her latest book, and her answers revealed a passion for the fantastic. She liked to be carried away into a world with new rules and possibilities, realms of fantasy and magic, and inevitable happy endings. Them wizard children, they got the spells and smarts to make all that evil go down, she'd say. They face their trouble and find an answer, always. When I praised these connections, told her what an excellent reader she was, she thanked me, impatient to return to the book, not wanting to talk about what she could experience. And so, mostly, I let her read. After all, I'd seen the house where she and Willie lived. I often took them home after school, since sometimes children would harass them if they walked. Their place was an eyesore in a neighborhood of aging shacks and tin-roofed hovels. The walls of the house were green with decay, and the windows had been sloppily boarded, the roof with a series of mismatched, overlapped sheets of plastic. The dirt yard was filled with food wrappers and empty beer cans, tossed in at the invitation of bags of garbage piled there to head height. The smell of rot was gagging, even from the car. Serenity would thank me, swing her book bag on, take Willie by the hand, and stride into that yard past the hill of garbage while I stood and waited for them to make it safely inside. One week in my unit on poetry, we wrote past, present, and future poems. I read Serenity's over her shoulder. My past, a pile of trash, baking in the sun. My present, a book that hurt to read. My future, a slap to the face. I stood stunned, then bent over her desk. Is that really true, honey? She put her chin to her chest and said nothing. Finally, I saw that she was staring at my silk tie, which had fallen across her hand. Sorry, I said. That's okay. She folded her hands on her desk. But your poem, Serenity. She turned to stare out the window where the day was blindingly bright. Her voice was small and quiet. It's just some words. Don't you worry, Mr. Copperman. I just like the way it sounded. I put my hand on hers. Well, Serenity, I like the way it sounds, too. She met my gaze, something she rarely did. There was a defiant firmness in her eyes, the recognition of something vast and awful that she faced with as much dignity as she could. If it sound good, then I guess it a good poem. I walk the ruin of Serenity's house for a half an hour. The fire is old, the ashes and soot dusted over and washed out, so that when I touch the burnt support beams, they barely mark my hand. I find the metal frame of a bed, the coil of springs half buried in dirt, here a burnt can or picture frame or oven rack, indistinguishable shards of glass that might have been beer bottles or cups or bowls. Nothing of significance. I picture the house as it was, imagine the flames eating it from within. It would have gone up quickly, those old dry boards already part air. Through the standing frame, there are patches of sky, the shiny leaves of the neighbor's magnolia, my rental car still running. Everything is open. I cast Serenity as a success story, the girl from the poor family who made good on the opportunity of my classroom. In my telling, I reached her, lifted her from her small circumstances into a bright, boundless future. I made her an anecdote, and so forgot her. In this windowless house, Serenity huddled, reading of a different world, dreamt herself in a different life. It's pretty to picture her the night of the fire, seizing that dress in her free hand and leading Willie out the door as the heat and smoke mounted, crossing the threshold to safety. There's no sign she died here, just as there is no assurance she wasn't trapped by the rising flames and faced her fate like a heroine, confirmed in the end she always knew was coming. I ask around. Nobody died in the fire. The family left for a time, and later somebody's cousin in Orange Mound heard from somebody else that Serenity and Willie were put temporarily in foster care. And that's all anyone is sure of. Back in the car, I sit in the cab and take comfort in the uncertainty. Serenity's alive and could be anywhere at all. Then I close my eyes and imagine her that night, standing in the street watching the fire consume everything she's ever known. After a time, she turns from the heat, stares into the surrounding dark, and believes for the first time in escape. We're speaking with Michael Copperman about his book, Teacher, 2 years in the Mississippi Delta. In this book, he recounts the 2 years that he spent teaching in one of the poorest school districts in the entire country, in the Delta region of the state of Mississippi. He did so teaching through a program called Teach for America. Particularly in the first of your 2 years teaching there, you were confronted with an especially challenging class. You had 24 fourth graders to teach, and you spell out just what a challenging group this was. And you also more than suggest, more than imply that it was not completely an accident that you had been given such an exceptionally challenging group of students.
Well, and there is no way to go back and be certain that this wasn't simply a quirk or accident of enrollments. I don't think that my principal, who really was extremely supportive, was attempting to cause me any great harm. I do think that there's the possibility, in part because there had been a male Teach for America teacher in the elementary school the year before, who was actually there with me my first year also, and he was very, very good with classroom management and with the children and with discipline and order. And so I think the idea was that I was supposed to be similarly talented because of my gender. And as it turned out, that was not the case. And I had a lot of very, very difficult young men in that particular class who had been previously identified as behavior problems. I simply didn't have control over the class for a great portion of my first months in the Delta.
Explain to our listeners your system that you started with, something called Behavior Bucks, with a sort of bank in the classroom. One of those ideas that maybe at a glance or on paper seems like it might just work, but was really hard to implement in real life. Explain what Behavior Bucks were.
Should have realized that capitalism was not going to be a victory. I had some idea, this perhaps came out of the institute that I had trained at, where four of us teachers charged with teaching 4 hours altogether each day with, you know, something like 10 or 12 students. And so, you know, I had come up with a behavior system in that group together that we had used, and I thought I would translate it into Mississippi. There are lots and lots of, as certainly elementary school educators will know, there are many different sorts of systems that you can use to reflect behavior back to children and help them help create a classroom culture which is effective and also sort of be positively influencing them, but also having there be consequences for bad behavior. My Behavior Bucks system, which was with artificially created currency with like dollars drawn on it and then colored in green marker, you know, it led to runs on the bank very quickly. Every time I turned my back, I couldn't keep my eye on the chart. And so some children would apparently end up immensely rich, not necessarily through any good behavior of their own. And other children would find that they had been robbed. The system was a disaster. And so I very quickly stopped recreating the wheel and implemented, you know, a more traditional behavior system with cards that signaled, you know, how a child had been behaving and that had either consequences or incentives built in.
That's Michael Kopperman talking about his experience of teaching fourth grade in one of the poorest school districts in the entire country, in the Delta region of the state of Mississippi, through the program Teach for America. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll hear more of this interview as he talks about his experiences in those 2 years in Promise, Mississippi. The book is Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, published by University Press of Mississippi.